You're listening to the Podcast Detroit Network. Visit www.podcastdetroit.com for more information.
But I've got someone to kill.
Oh, good Lord, there's some bitter irony in those lyrics today. God rest the souls of all the people that that lost their lives in Vegas last night while they were just out trying to have a good time. And then also today, the news about Tom Petty having a cardiac arrest and then being, rushed to the hospital. And I'd heard there were reports that he had passed away, and then there were reports that those other reports had been premature. But either way, if he doesn't make it, then God rest his soul as well. And hopefully he pulls through. Hell of a Monday either way. It's Monday evening. Nonetheless, we are here. The show is called American Whiner. We are on podcastdetroit.com, Studio 3. Thank you for joining us. My guest tonight is a renowned local blues singer. He's also the owner of the Boogie Woogie Barbecue restaurant in Pinckney. Mr. Chef Chris, sir, how are you?
I'm good. How are you, Alex?
I'm good. Thanks so much for coming on, man.
It's my pleasure.
We always start off the show with the exact same question, and that question is, where were you born?
Detroit.
Detroit?
I was born, Detroit at Mount Carmel Hospital in the Motor City.
All righty. What did your parents do for a living?
My father was a commercial artist. He worked at a couple different big ad agencies in Detroit, Young and Rubicon, Campbell Ewald. He did some big campaigns. His group did ads for Chevy back in the 70s. They coined the baseball, hot dogs, apple pie, and Chevrolet.
Oh, really?
Spot. Yep. He did later. He worked for, I can't remember the last place he worked, but they did Chrysler, and he worked with Lee Iacocca back in the early 90s. They did a lot of those ads during Chrysler's resurgence for the Jeep and SUVs, and did a lot of print ad stuff. So he had a long career in the commercial art business, and my mother was a homemaker. She ran the household. And I was one of five kids, so she, I think, actually worked harder than my dad.
were you the oldest?
Nope. I have three older sisters and a younger brother.
Okay. And did you grow up in Detroit?
No, we grew up in Livonia.
Livonia. Okay.
Yeah. So, but born in Detroit, all of us were born down there. My parents were both born in Detroit and lived in Detroit, and then I think sometime in the late 50s, early 60s, they migrated out to Livonia.
All right. Well, what kind of a student were you growing up in Livonia?
Horrible. I think I did good through through elementary school and maybe junior high, but by the time I was in high school, I was pretty disinterested in the whole process. I think the thing that really kept me going was I played football. I loved playing football, and I had a good core of friends that I met in elementary school and hung with them all the way through high school. But I wasn't a model student. I mean, I graduated, and I actually did go to college very briefly, but I made it through one semester of college and had absolutely no interest in that, so I moved on.
Really quick, what position did you play when you were when you played football?
By the time I was a senior, I played offensive guard, and I played linebacker. I played nose guard. I played center somewhat, but toward the end, the last few years, I was offensive guard and pretty much nose guard, linebacker.
Okay. Was there any career ambitions there as far as football went?
No, I mean, well, of course. I mean, any kid has that fantasy of, I think they think they're, going to go off and and play ball, but I never got recruited or anything, so I don't think I was fast enough. Mm-hmm. I was certainly strong enough, but I never got recruited. Not many of the guys on our team did.
And when you said you went to college for a little bit, where did you go?
Well, I hate to say this, but I went to Ohio State.
Oh, really?
Yeah, when I was a senior in high school, my father had gotten his company he worked for. They opened up offices down in Columbus, Ohio, and so the family moved to Columbus, and that's where I graduated. I graduated from Dublin High School, and then it was just an easy transition to go to Ohio State. It's a state college. Everybody gets accepted. And, I did it for about 10 weeks and just moved on. Wasn't for me.
You didn't really see anything for yourself there? You didn't want to study any particular subject or anything?
I was interested in broadcast journalism. But no, I mean, I was, I didn't know what I wanted to do then. I was fortunate enough to get a job at a 4-star restaurant in Columbus, Ohio, and worked with a European chef who was, he was actually a member of the U.S. Culinary Olympic team. And so I got entrenched in the culinary world at that time. And that was pretty much, my education.
Mm-hmm.
And, getting into food, it wasn't like I loved doing it. I was just good at it. I made money and was able to have my own apartment, my own car. And, I never was, I didn't really sign on for the formal education, but I can say that I did get a pretty good education in those kitchens.
Yeah. So it sounds like you just jumped right into it then. It chose you pretty much almost.
That's exactly what I am. I mean, I'm a kind of guy that's going to jump into the frying pan and react to what's going on and figure things out and go from there. And I was very fortunate to work with that chef. His name is Edgar Zillner. He was from Germany and he was my mentor. And I was just amazed at what that guy could do. And there were a couple other really good trained chefs in that restaurant. It was a famous restaurant. It's called the Grandview Inn. It was a stopover for jazz musicians going from New York to Chicago. So some like Count Basie played there, Duke Ellington. I mean, not when I was there, but they did back in the day. And so that was part of the lore of the place. And it was just ultra fine dining. So I loved it. I mean, 19 years old, working in that environment was pretty good. And my mom was quite a, she loved food. She loved cooking and she was really good at it. And I know your listeners, I suppose they can go on the internet and see pictures of me, but it's pretty obvious that I don't miss too many meals. and back then, you'd come home from school or work or whatever and, you might have, she had some staples that she did like any other mother, but you might have stuffed clams for dinner one night or grilled scallops or, Chateaubriand or leg of lamb. And, we weren't the kind of family that had, fast food or TV dinners. Not that there's anything, wrong with that, I suppose, but we just didn't do it. And, I loved it. And so as I got into my cooking, my mom would make brunches and, we might have prime rib and eggs Benedict or something for a home cooked meal on a Sunday afternoon. And, we were learning, I was learning how to cook those things at the restaurant. I was just always amazed at the amount of work that my mom put into that. And when I was learning it, I always came home and said, geez, mom, if we just had a bigger kitchen, this whole thing would be so much easier for you. But so, my mom was quite an influence on me as far as cooking goes. But again, when I got into it, I mean, it wasn't like I picked being a chef. I just kind of did it.
Well, so you go through high school and you're a football player, and you try out college, you don't like it, but then you immediately get pulled into the food industry, and you'd already kind of recognized a passion for that from your mother. So at this, what was going on with the blues singing at this point? Was that even a thing at this point, or had that not come about yet?
No, that hadn't come about. I didn't actually start playing music till I was 28 years old. I never sang a note or played any instrument or anything, but I've always had music in my blood. My mom, part of the, you know, growing up with her, these extraordinary meals that she would put on, there was always some really cool music in the background too. She was a fan of, you know, like the crooners, so she listened to a lot of Frank Sinatra and, oh, you know, the Count Basie Orchestra and you know, a lot of jazz. So she liked Miles Davis and Duke Ellington, and, you know, she listened to a lot of NPR jazz, and, you know, the whole scene just really stuck to me. But I often tell people way before, I mean, I think I came out of the womb singing. And my mom tells a story of when she would take me shopping, grocery shopping or something. I used to walk through the halls of the grocery store singing "Hey Jude." I couldn't put together a sentence, but I could sing all of "Hey Jude." And I was always fascinated, and always just liked music. And, you know, back in the days of the early days of me, you know, in the culinary world, I mean, I was just like any other kid that around. I listened to, you know, the Stones and Led Zeppelin and Tom Petty, you know, anything that was commercial rock and roll. But around that time, I think when I was about 18, 19 years old, because I lived down there at, off of campus at Ohio State, you know, they had great record stores, and I would spend hours in those places, you know, and I'd hear something, you know, some music in a movie or something, and I had to find out what it was. And I would literally, like, I wouldn't know the name of a song, and I'd go into a record store and sing it to, you know, to the clerk, and then they would point in the direction, and I would spend hours in those places and bought hundreds, if not thousands, of albums and tapes and whatnot. And, you know, when I wasn't working or carousing around, I spent a lot of time in front of my stereo.
So if you had all this passion for music, you know, throughout your entire life, then so how did you, why until 28, did you not try to do anything earlier? Or did it just not come about, or how did that go?
There was a short stint where I tried. Back in Columbus, there's a famous radio station called WMMS out of Cleveland. It's like a classic, you know, hard rocking station. And there was a rehearsal studio there called MMS Rehearsals. And I met a guy that I worked with that said he played bass. And I was always singing in the kitchen. And so we got together and started to rehearse, you know, fool around with music in my apartment. And he got us hooked up at that rehearsal, the MMS Rehearsals, and we tried out for bands. And I was, you know, pretty much told I can't sing, and I didn't know how to play an instrument. So my, you know, it was very short-lived. It was just sort of a hobby thing. But then as I got older, you know, my friends that I grew up with had started getting married and having kids. You know, I was looking for something to do. And, you know, fast forward to 28 years old, I'm the head chef at the Woodward Grill in downtown Birmingham there. And I would have a boombox in the kitchen and usually playing the blues or something, but loudly singing. And one of the waiters there came back to me and goes, you know, chef, I don't know why you're working in this kitchen. You need to get into a blues band. You've just got the voice. You've got the look. You should do that. And so, you know, the Metro Times, I just picked up a Metro Times, and in the back of it, there was ads for bands looking for a front man. And I thought I'd give it another shot. So I went down to a tryout in the Indian Village there in Detroit for, you know, a band looking for a front man. And I knew a few of the tunes that they were going to play. And I mean, like I said, I never really sang in front of a band before, but I jumped right in and they liked me and picked me. And so there you have it. If I had not gotten picked, I probably would have just gone right back into the kitchen and said, ah, you know, I gave it a shot. But, so that was it. You know, once it was like a dog getting its first taste of blood, and I just couldn't get enough of it. And so I threw myself into it and have been doing it ever since.
Yeah. So you were off then. I got to ask, what made you gravitate towards the blues in the first place?
I just love it. You know, as a kid, I was like I said before, I was like any other kid listening to whatever rock and roll music was out there. But as I would delve in deeper into albums like Led Zeppelin, for instance, you know, like half of their albums were blues covers, or, you know, as they later said that they didn't cover blues, but they did. You know, it was just those primal rhythms, you know, that 12-bar blues. And to me, those songs were more fascinating than the big hits. And, you know, you name any of those, you know, the Stones, the Who, they all borrowed from that. You know, Eric Clapton, of course, Cream, all those bands had at least one or two blues covers. And then, you know, they later would release entire albums with their blues heroes, you know, like Eric Clapton and did an album with Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf, and, you know, all those British produced albums. So I just gravitated to it. You know, I remember Aerosmith did a tune, Walking the Dog, off one of their first albums, and that was my favorite song. They did another one called Big 10 Inch, and then I was just blown away that they didn't write these songs.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to find out who did. And then once I opened up that box, there was a whole other world of stuff that took me in that direction. And plus, you know, my mom, like I said, she listened to those crooners. And you listen to Count Basie, you're going to get a heavy dose of blues. And so that's just where my ear went.
Well, and you've had so between your cooking and your singing, you've had quite a career since that time. I remember when I was first introduced to you, which, I mean, that's going on. That was years ago now. I can't even remember when it was, but I was told that you had opened for the Black Keys, which is one of my favorite bands. So mm-hmm. You've played with how many bands have you played with since you first started singing?
Well, when I first started, I was in a band called the Urban Electric Blues Band, and I think maybe that band lasted 3-4 months. So there's bands that I just don't count. There's another one that was called the Steamrollers, which I had a guy that I collaborated with for quite a while. He goes by the name of Uncle Warren, and he was really an important person for me to be involved with, because he was up for anything, especially if it was creative. And he didn't mind that I was so horrible. You know, I mean, I listened to tapes from back then. We were recording everything we did. And but he was horrible, too. You know, so we were just kind of, you know, figuring it out ourselves, but we just kept doing it. Warren and I started a band called the Nairobi Trio, and he played an upright bass, and we were sort of tired of the whole... it just seemed like in the, you know, the early mid 90s, everybody was covering Jimi Hendrix or Stevie Ray Vaughan, and they were doing that rocked up version of the blues, which is cool. But we were into deeper stuff, I think. And we just wanted to go off and do, you know, something unique and original. And then, we were playing with a couple guys that had problems with alcohol and drugs, and, you know, it wasn't uncommon for one of them to fall asleep on stage while we're playing. But when we were playing one night, we got the attention of some serious musicians in town, and they already knew who I was, or both of us really, but, you know, we were still just a couple of guys that were, you know, just trying to get our shit together. And they were a rhythm section. You know, one guy played guitar, the other one played drums, but they offered their services to us, and boom, the Nairobi Trio went from, you know, is so-and-so going to show up? Are we going to be able to play this gig, to a bona fide thing? And so then we started, you know, I started working hard to get us gigs all over the place, and it was easy to do. And so as time went by, Warren had kind of moved on, and we replaced him with a local bass player who's kind of legendary. His name is John Frega. He's since passed away. We used him for a while, and then along the way, I got into a band out of Ann Arbor called the Witch Doctors, which is led by Theron. Theron X, he owns his own radio station, Wham Radio, there in Ann Arbor, and he was famous for having a show called the Bone Conduction Music Show. So I got into his band and was with them for a couple of years, but it was the bass player that I worked with in that band. I recruited him to this other band, the Nairobi Trio, and then we added Vinny Dombrowski from Sponge.
Oh, I didn't know you played with him. Yeah, I love Sponge.
Yeah. And once Vinny got involved on the drums, it took another few, more than a few, but giant steps up. And so really the Nairobi, I guess my roundabout way of saying that the Nairobi Trio is my main band that I've ever had. And it's the band that I've done the most with. That guitar player I told you about, his name is Sir Tim Duvalier. I've been playing with him ever since, you know, like 20 some odd years now. And but that band, you know, it was just a quirky, creative band that, you know, we focused on the tunes that I wrote, and these, you know, I picked oddball tunes for us to do, and we would often, you know, like we took Folsom Prison Blues and just really manipulated that into a whole different thing. And that's what we did in our shows. And you know, we were playing. I had one gig with that band. It was on Sunday afternoons at a bar out in Manchester. And we were packing the place, and we would play from 5 o'clock in the afternoon to 9, and there'd be, you know, over 100 people in that bar. And you know, we did it for a couple of years. And along the way, I was like, well, you know what, be nice to have this band play somewhere else. I mean, if we can pack a little place out here in the middle of nowhere, we should be able to play like at the Memphis Smoke or, you know, all the places in town that were having blues. And so I signed us up to the Detroit Battle of the Blues Bands, and we won that competition. And unbeknownst to us at the time, the winner of that would go would be sent to Memphis, Tennessee to compete at the International Blues Challenge. And like I said, I had no idea. I mean, we got involved in the Detroit Battle of the Bands because we wanted a gig at Memphis Smoke, you know? So we end up going to Memphis and we win that too. We get named, you know, we went up against like 70 bands from around the country. I played for 3 nights on Beale Street. And we were named by the Blues Foundation as the best unsigned blues band in the world.
Oh,
that was
my
the
God.
Official. Right. So now, you know, before we left Memphis, I'm having meetings with the president of the Blues Foundation. I met the guy who, you know, owns Gibson Guitars. I'm getting just, people just loved us. They were comparing us to, Captain Beefheart, and guys like Screamin' Jay Hawkins, and I mean it was incredible. I mean, the judges were guys like Bob Margolin, you know, who played for a long time in Muddy Waters Band, and just serious radio people like the guy who was on the ground floor with XM Satellite Radio. And so we had, at that time when we won that competition, we were told to come back to Memphis and a few months to play at the Handy Awards. I mean, we'd be on stage with B.B. King. And it was, they dubbed it the Sun Records Handy Awards. So, I mean, guys, whoever was still alive, like Sam Phillips was a presenter at that. We were, ended up playing that Handy Awards and were introduced to the crowd by Dr. John. So, I mean, that band, what I'm getting at is, once again, Chef Chris just jumping into the fire and making things happen. And we go from playing Sunday afternoons at a podunk bar in the middle of nowhere to all over the country. And, you know, we were being contacted by several record companies for contracts, and that never happened. As I read later, people would say, you either have the contract or you don't. We never did, but what we did get to do was travel and play all the major blues festivals all over the Midwest and through the South. And we had gigs that we could have done in California, and we didn't go all the way out there because it just wasn't, we just couldn't do it. We weren't going to get paid enough money to be away for that long. And so along the way, we knew we were going to be on the road. So we quickly got into a studio and put together a demo, and those demos, that guy from XM Radio, for instance, our version of Folsom Prison Blues, he just loved it, and it got airplay. And then as a result of that, we started getting contacted by a guy who places music in, movies. And well, we never got into that, but it was interesting to me that this guy would contact me about once a year or so with another one of our songs. And I remember talking to him on the phone. I said, do you just have my number on the wall, or, he goes, no, I listen to a lot of music, and the stuff that jumps into my ears is I make contact. I said, well, this is the third time you've contacted me. I said, so is this going to be it? I mean, are we going to get on one of these movies? And, some of the movies he was talking about was like, he placed all the music for I think it was called Walk On, it was the story of Johnny Cash.
Oh, Walk the Line. Yeah.
Yeah, Walk the Line. And another one, I forget them now, but they weren't the biggest. I mean, that was the biggest movie. But that band ended up, having about a 2-3 year run where we were playing out of town more than we were playing in town. And we played in Memphis several times, and Nashville, and through Georgia and Florida, all those big festivals. And we were selling, we put together that CD, and then we put together another one. And I remember we did a festival in Pennsylvania one time. And, usually you can expect to sell, 20, 25, maybe 30 CDs at a show. And we sold regularly. We're selling 300 and 400 CDs at a show. So, I mean, I've really thought that band had arrived. I thought we were going to become a household name. And along the way, we did open for the Black Keys. I wouldn't say that we opened for them like if you go see like the Rolling Stones or something, and they have a band open for them. We were just a part of a show, but we were always on like right before them. Like we played at the locally at the Antifreeze Blues Festival in Ferndale. And then we also played with them in Tampa and Fort Lauderdale. But this is back in it's probably 2002 or 2003. So they really weren't, the big name.
Yeah, they were just starting out then. Their first album came out in 2002. So that must have been, that sounds like an incredible experience, though, to have done all that.
We played with guys like Joe Bonamassa a couple times, Sonny Landreth, it goes, and all these people were just sort of, drifting. They were clearly more established than we were, but we were right in the thick of that. So,
well, I got to say, normally this is where we would take our break, but this is so interesting that I'm just going to keep talking to you. We're just going to talk right through it.
Okay.
Because I also wanted to, in addition, so we'll finish up talking about your blues career, and then I want to ask you about the Boogie Woogie Barbecue before I ask you what you want to whine about. So the Nairobi Trio is going like crazy. And so like around when would you say like it started to like, I don't want to say taper off, but like at some point it sounds like you guys started to sort of cool off a little bit. What happened with that?
Well, when I tell the story, it was pretty sudden, actually. Like I said, we were out playing quite a bit out of town, and we were playing locally too. We used to play at the Music Menu regularly. We had still had our Sunday gig. That moved to another bar. And but I don't know if you recall when about that time, 2003, I think it was, the entire Midwest had a blackout.
Yeah, I do remember that.
Well, we had just gotten back from, you know, some show that we did somewhere, and we were scheduled to play several of the Jazz Fest in Ann Arbor, a few other gigs, and they all got canceled except for that Jazz Fest we ended up doing. But all these local gigs that we were playing at got canceled because they didn't have power. Mm-hmm. And they didn't have it for whatever reason. And no big deal. Well, it never really materialized. These bars, some of them just stopped doing, the music menu closed shortly around that time. We were playing at the Tap Room in Ypsilanti quite a bit, and they were renovating the space next door. They stopped having music. And I mean, part of it too was probably I just wasn't working that hard anymore at getting gigs or finding new places to play. But as far as the out of town stuff, it stopped. It just, like I said, you either have that contract or you don't. And, we went and played all that stuff, but we never really, we needed somebody to help us. We needed somebody to, I think, manage us and keep that intensity going and finding new venues for us to play. And that person that did that was me. And hell, at the time when we first won that International Blues Jams, I didn't even have a cell phone. I didn't have a computer. I didn't even have an email address. So I learned how to do all that stuff as a necessity for the band. And, but you know, I'm not making any excuses. It just kind of, for whatever reason, the flame was out. And, then we, you know, the guys like Vinny, you know, his band Sponge, that was always his thing. I mean, so we constantly would have to find replacements for him. And when you do a big gig, you know, out of town, and you show up with, you know, a sub, it just kind of the thing kind of loses. It'd be like going to see Led Zeppelin and they're not going to have John Bonham. Mm-hmm. You know, or you know, that kind of thing. And I think it just was part of the what was going on at the time. And then Tim, the guitarist, he had other interests too. They put together their band, the Orbitsons, and they had a lot of work with that. And, you know, it just kind of started to fizzle. And I found it harder and harder to book them. So I still had gigs. And so I just started hiring, you know, other guys. And it got to the point where it was just, you know, me and the bass player from the Nairobi Trio, and we'd have a different drummer and a different guitar player. So we just called it a different band. And for a while it was called the Blue Plate Specials, Chef Chris and the Blue Plate Specials. And that's another band. I mean, we just played on Sunday afternoons at Northfield Roadhouse to a packed house. I mean, it's 150 people every Sunday afternoon to see us play. And that band had great players. Brett Lucas, he plays with Betty Levette. He's got his own bands. He's just a tremendous guitar player. And Julian Van Slyke, the drummer, he played with Kim Wilson of the Fabulous Thunderbirds. And, you know, he's just a fabulous drummer. But that band just never really, we put out one record. It's called Horny Farm Girl. And it got some airplay and stuff, but it just never took off like that Nairobi Trio did. And then, same thing happened there. Brett got hooked up with Betty Levette or somebody else. And we were getting subs for him all the time. And he introduced me to Dylan Dunbar. And Dylan was one of the guitar players from the Rump Shakers. And, you know, Dylan was great. He reminded me of my buddy Warren when I, you know, first met him. You know, he was very eager to play and was very interested in doing that hill country blues. He wasn't interested in, you know, just covering, it's kind of watered down blues, loud, but he was into, he liked Junior Kimbrough and, and R.L. Burnside and that kind of stuff. But, you know, so did I. And I would just go out to his house, and his, you know, his buddy Jack was the drummer. So it was really easy to just the three of us start putting together material. And for a while we had a guitar player, and it was, again, he was a guy that would show up drunk, and one time he pissed himself on stage and fell into the drums.
Oh my Lord. That's a real rock and roll show right there. When the guitarist pisses himself.
Yep. And then that's when Danny Muggs from the Muggs band, local rock and roll band, you know, got interested. And so we brought him aboard, and, you know, we
started. Oh, you played with Danny Methrick too, huh?
Yep. Yep. That was the Rum Shakers. It was me and Danny, Dylan and Jack Schneider. And, you know, we ended up doing like that, the Comerica Fest, with, you know, Buddy Guy was on that show and all the local people. And, we were playing several bars around town. We started playing out of town, got gigs down in Ohio. And I think we might've had one in Chicago. So yeah, I mean,
so you never stopped then. You just you've continued to pursue this, and I mean, you're naturally good at it, as you said before. So who are you playing with nowadays then?
Well, I'm back with the Nairobi Trio that I generally will, if I have a gig and those guys are available. So I, you know, me and Sir Tim Duvalier, long time collaborator with him, you know. So me and him and Bill Lewis, the bass player from the Nairobi Trio, and then we bring along Julian Van Slyke, the guy I mentioned him earlier. And sometimes we try to get a hold of Vinny, but man, Sponge is really, I mean, I think right now they're in California. I think I said read somewhere they're playing at the Whiskey Go-Go sometime this week. So he's tough to get on a caper, but, yeah, usually it'll be me and Tim and Bill and Julian, and it's the Nairobi Trio. And then after that, if I can't put that thing together, I try to do something with the Rump Shakers. But, you know, they too, Dylan, the guitar player, got married this past summer, and him and his wife, Jennifer Westwood, they right now they're out of town for a couple months, you know. Mm-hmm. So they're hitting the trail, and it's, you know, hard to book him too. So, you know, well, I just have to do what I've always done and just find somebody to back me up.
Yeah, man. Well, and so the other thing that you've got going on is the Boogie Woogie Barbecue. And I want to ask you about that and how that came about. Let's talk about that.
All right. Well, when I was when we got back from, like I told you, when the Nairobi Trio thing was fizzling out, the gigs were sort of drying up. I wanted to work. You know, we had my girlfriend and I, whom, I mean, we're not married, but we've been together for about 17 years. We had just bought a house. She had two small kids, and, you know, I wanted to, you know, playing in bands is great. But unless you're really, like when we were in the heyday of the Nairobi Trio, if you're selling merchandise, then you're making money. But if you're not, then, you know, you're playing for $100 a night, and, you know, 3-4 nights a week, it still doesn't get it. So I got back into the, you know, my bread and butter. I've been working in restaurants since I was a teenager, and, you know, I was the head chef at the Woodwork Grill in Birmingham. I was the head chef at Pine Trace Golf Club in Rochester Hills. I worked in Disney World of Florida for a couple years as a chef. And, so I figured I'd dive back into that to earn money. And I got a job at this place in, it's Northfield, which is just off of 23, just north of Ann Arbor. It's called the Northfield Roadhouse. And it was like a dream come true. The place was completely committed to having blues bands play on the weekend, and they wanted to do, barbecue as their cuisine. And I had at the time had only been dabbling in barbecue. I became fascinated with it when the band was touring through the South. You know, we would play at a festival in Arkansas, and you know, be treated to the most amazing barbecue food that, I mean, I just never knew it could be that good. You know, from my training, barbecue meant, you know, grilling burgers and hot dogs and slapping open pit on chicken or something. But so while we were out on the road all the time, I was checking out those huge smokers and talking with guys that were cooking it. And I started to study it. And I said to Kathy, I was like, you know, if I ever get back into the restaurant business, I really think I'd like to try doing barbecue. And so that job came about at the Northfield Roadhouse. And that's what we did. It was blues and barbecue and Cajun. And that my band played on Sundays. And it lasted for about a year and a half. But, you know, that place was poorly run. The people that owned it were, you know, they weren't restaurant people. And in like most cases, there was alcohol and drugs involved and pretty unreliable. And it just, the writing was on the wall. I knew that place wasn't going to make it. So I started branching out on my own. We were getting contacted a lot to do pig roasts at the Roadhouse. And, you know, one of the owners there told me, you know, specifically that he didn't want to do pig roasts or any kind of catering. He just, you know, so I just said, hey, well, you know, do you mind if I try it on my own? And he's like, no, I don't give a shit what you do on your own time. So I started renting equipment to do pig roasts, you know, and only did a couple of them, but was like, wow, you know, this is, I think I can, you know, make a living doing this. And so then I left the Northfield Roadhouse and bought a hog roaster and, you know, started doing private parties on my own. And for like the next year or so, I acquired my smoker that you've seen up at the Boogie Woogie Barbecue, and we bought a concession trailer. So for a couple of years, I basically did the food truck thing, only it wasn't like one truck. I had a truck with a trailer on it and then another trailer with a smoker on it. But I would set up on Highway 50 out near Michigan International Speedway on weekends and sell barbecue on the roadside. And then that led to me getting gigs barbecuing at festivals. And then plus at these festivals, I could talk them into having me play the festival with the band. So for a couple of years, you know, I would barbecue at a festival or a fair or fireworks or something. And then my band would also play. It was really the, you know, the 1-2 punch. And, but by the second year that we were, I mean, full time doing this, what happened was every weekend, it just seemed to rain. We just had bad weather. Like the first half of the summer was just rain. So, you know, I'd have $3,000-$4,000 worth of food, and no customers because nobody were, you know, there'd be people at these like Gratiot cruise we did out in, 1 year, and it rained, that Friday and Saturday. And I just basically lost my ass. So, and that kept going on, and I had to invest in a huge freezer. and then just had to, you know, I mean, I almost went bankrupt. I mean, I was broke. I wasn't making any money. And then Kathy, you know, we had at the end of the season that year, we got asked to do like a car show. It was in October and it was kind of chilly outside. And I was like, okay, sure. We had a freezer full of leftover stuff and we set up and we sold every single thing that we had. I mean, every crumb, every morsel, every single thing. People were licking the barbecue sauce off the squirt bottles. And, you know, it made me feel really good. You know, I was like, man, I said, if we would have just had this, you know, the weather was just horrible this year. And Kathy said, well, if you ever had like a, you know, a brick and mortar place, it would be, you know, you could always have your stuff for sale. And then a couple months later, a friend of mine, one of the guys that was one of the owners there at that Northfield Roadhouse, shows up at my house and asked me if I had ever heard of this place called Smoking Chicks up in Pinckney. And I'm like, nope, never heard of it. And he goes, well, you got to check it out because it's been empty for months and it's set up perfectly for you. So I'm like, yeah, let's go right now. And so we jump in my car, we drive over there, get a cup of coffee at the diner next door, called the number on the door at the Smokin' Chicks place, and within an hour, the landlord was there, gave me a tour of the place, and asked me what I wanted to do, and I said, I want to turn this into a, you know, a barbecue restaurant, and he was like, well, I don't think that that'll work. I'm like, why not? And he goes, well, nobody eats that food, you know, more than once a week. It's, you know, it's good, but it's just, he goes, I want to get like a national chain like Subway in here. And I said, well, you know, I've been doing it for a couple of years, and we were booked on all those fairs and festivals again. I said, this would really just give me an opportunity to have the brick and mortar place, you know, where people could come in and they could try our food, and it might expand me into doing like graduation parties and more festivals and bigger, you know, things. I said, so basically I already have the work. I just, you know, having a kitchen would be helpful. And he hemmed and hawed about it, and he did some research about me, and then he just called me and he said, you're my guy. And so I went and met with him, signed the lease, and a month later I was open for business.
Wow. And what year was that?
2008. Yep. So we've been almost 10 years.
And and I have to say, man, I've been wanting to give you this compliment since the first time I ate there. But your barbecue is the only barbecue in the Metro Detroit area that doesn't give me heartburn. I don't know why. I don't know what you do differently, but that's the only place I can go where I'm not, you know, on the way home, I don't start feeling like there's a dragon in my throat. So excellent. And you should say, where are you located in Pinckney? The crossroads.
Well, we're the Chilson and M36. We're on the corner there, the northwest corner of Chilson and M36 in the Hamburg Village Shopping Center.
Okay. Well, that, man, I'm so glad. I keep, every time I have a guest come on this show and we just talk and talk, and I'm like, I need to make this show longer because there's so much to get into. We are at the point where I'm going to ask you, what do you want to whine about, Chef Chris?
Well, we might as well stick with the restaurant world. My beef is regulations. It's, I don't have a problem, or I'm not an enemy of, like, the health department, but I really have a problem with the sudden rules that the health department will drop on me. And every time they do this stuff, it comes with a price tag, and they're all, you know, they're all well-intended programs that are set up to protect people. And I think that's all well and good, but at some point I think adults can take responsibility for their own, you know, well-being. Like you just mentioned, you get heartburn in other restaurants eating barbecue, and you know that, so you don't go to those places anymore.
Right.
And specifically, what I'm talking about is we recently were told that we have to take a course to learn about when people are allergic to gluten or peanuts or, you know, any other myriad of allergens that are out there. And I can either do it online, or I have to go to the health department, sit down for a day and take a class, and costs like, I think it's like $300. In addition to that, I pay around $1,000 a year for a food service license, and every 5 years I have to renew my food service certificate. You know, and at 52 years old, I've been in the business for, you know, over 30 years. At what point are people going to have confidence that I don't serve? You know, I've never had a violation where people have gotten sick or anything. I know that that's being, you know, a bit oversimplifying things. But frankly, I mean, I have to take a day out of my time to learn about food allergens when I just look at it like the person that's stricken with these allergies, they would know more and about it than me.
Yeah.
And we do have a system for that there. When people come in and they ask, is there, this ingredient in any of the dishes that you have. We have a chart that we pull out from under our register, and we look through it, and we can answer those questions with confidence. And I just don't think that the government needs to tell me to take a course and pay them money to do that.
Yeah, that's absolutely ridiculous that they make you pay $300. It's one thing to make you do it, but it's another thing to say, and it also costs you $300 for us to give you this information that we didn't need, that we're making you, you know, we're forcing on you. Are these rules that you're talking about, are they like across the board for like small businesses and like for everybody, like chain restaurants? Like if that Subway had moved in instead of you, would they have had to follow these rules as well, or is it just small businesses?
Nope, they would. I think every single restaurant, anybody that's in food service, you know, so big hotels, you know, small places like mine, a gas station, you know, where they might serve hot dogs. They have to be served safe, certified. It's all very well intended, but to me, it's, you know, I'm going back. I started working in restaurants in the late 70s, and I've seen a lot of changes through my entire career, and I'm not sure that, you know, I don't like to oversimplify things, so I just stick to what, you know, what affects me. I just think it's overreaching. I think it's just another hoop that I've got to, and it, you know, as I get older, I just don't feel like doing more. But, you know, I already do enough, you know, within the context of, you know, so.
Yeah, I don't blame you. And that's the reason I asked that question is because I don't know why, like, you know, you have one location that you run and it's your passion and you're really good at what you do and you've been doing it for a long time. Why the hell should you have to play by the same rules as Subway? You know, I understand, like you said, it's all well and good and making sure protecting people and all that. But it seems to me that you should have your own tier of regulations and they should have their own tier of regulations. What do you think of that?
Yep. Well, I think it's a great thing. I think that, yeah, I mean, if you could say, hey, look, this is my track record. I've been in this location for 10 years and you can look up all of my, you know, my scores. They inspect us twice a year and those are all made public. So, I mean, at what point do you get credit for being a good, restaurateur? And, but you know, and it's not just that, I mean, the girl came when they did the smoking thing, you know, I was really, had a problem with the smoking laws. I just thought, you know, these people are paying taxes, you're paying rent, you're paying your mortgage, whatever, however you have your business set up. If you want to let people smoke in there, you should be allowed to. But these people come in from, you know, the health department and they hold, you know, they have that power over you. You're not allowed to do it. And that's just an example. And, you know, the smoking laws, I think, largely have, you know, people live with it now. I forget how many years it's been since that's happened.
Yeah, that was 2010 is when they enforced that. I remember that now. Yeah, 7 years.
Yep. And an old guy like me, I mean, I can tell you that when I was in my 20s, I would have never thought that smoking in a bar would be against the law.
Mm-hmm.
And here it is. It is the law. But frankly, I don't even notice it anymore.
Yeah, you're right. I completely forgot that. As soon as you mentioned the smoking ban, I'm like, oh my God, you're right. For the first, you know, 24 years of my life, people had that. It's been gone 7 years, and I completely forgot about it already. So,
yep.
In your opinion, how would you fix this? Like, how would you go about the regulations process in order to make it more friendly to businesses like yours?
Well, maybe they could have a grade scale, like you said. You know, this guy's been operating at a high level for X amount of years. It should be worth something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they could say, you know, this is Chef Chris. He's you know, clearly a professional. You know, ask him, you know, tell him that we would like to, what kind of training can you have for, you know, food allergens. And I could have presented them my system. And, you know, Kathy, when she worked with me, this was her idea, because we do have people come in that want to know if is there sesame in any of our barbecue sauces. There's usually soy sauces, the soy, is there soy in anything? And we can answer that question because we wrote all those recipes. We don't, you know, but I always do tell people too. I said, you know, if you're really on the fence about it, I mean, I don't mind losing the customer. I know that sounds odd, but I would hate to think that somebody would get sick, you know, because I used a different ketchup in my barbecue sauce and it had soy in it. You know, so I pretty much remind them, you know, we don't think it's in there, but, you know, and it's like enter at your own risk. Mm-hmm. And I just think that so solving it, like I said, we have a chart and it works perfectly. You know, I don't know in a larger restaurant, you'd have to provide training to your staff, you know. To know those things, but you know, they give us charts for foodborne illnesses already in restaurants. There could be a chart for, you know, different allergens, and you know, and they kind of do that. I mean, like shellfish, you have to save the tags that come with if you buy clams or mussels, or you save those tags because they tell where they were harvested. And if there's a food outbreak, they can pinpoint where it came from. You know, so I mean, those charts that we have charts in the back of our kitchen that show you how if somebody's choking, you know, they show you how to help a person that's choking, you know. So there could be a chart. Mm-hmm. Charts are, you know, wonderful things. And with all these programs too, like we use the Square app for our register at the store, and they have apps for recipe building. You know, that's where you find out, you know, if something has a potential, something potential that can harm somebody. You just plug in your ingredients and where you get them from. Everything's on a database. And it can tell you, you know, is there soy, is there sesame, is there peanut, whatever it can, you know, whatever it could be, could be just right there in plain English. You know, I would think that it could get kind of complicated for sure. I mean, if you go to McDonald's or, you know, Wendy's or something like that and go to Wendy's and look at their chili recipe, I'm sure, there's 1,000 words in that recipe, whereas mine, there's 10 things in mm-hmm. that recipe, you know. But
well, so there's a way to do it to make everybody happy and also keep people safe, though. So it sounds like.
Yep.
So well, sure. This has been a great interview, man. I usually don't do this, but I want to finish off the interview with. I got two quick questions for you, and then we'll wrap it up. But the first question is, what is your favorite dish to prepare? At your restaurant?
You know, I would think that gumbo is my favorite thing that I make. We haven't been making it lately because it just doesn't sell. But gumbo is one of the first things that I made. I mean, I really, you know, I'm into barbecue and stuff, but before that I was into Cajun food deeply. I mean, when I first started at that restaurant in Columbus, Ohio, Cajun was a part of the menu there, and I learned to make etouffee and gumbo and jambalaya. So gumbo is my favorite thing to make there.
Okay, that's what I'm getting the next time I come out there. The second question is, what is your favorite song to sing?
Oh, man, you know, there's...
I know I'm putting you on the spot. But
right. I'll tell you, there's this one that I've been doing since I started, and it's a cover. And it's called, what the hell's the name of it? I almost have to play the harmonica to remember the words. It's by, can't remember the guy's name. It sounds bad. It's supposed to be my favorite song, and I can't remember the, Come Back, I Wish You Would is the name of the song.
Okay.
And, it's early in the morning, about the break of day. Bump, 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 bump. That's my baby went away. That's just a great old Chicago blues thing. The harp player that wrote it was Bo Diddley's harp player. And I just can't remember his name off the top of my head. It's called I Wish You Would. So look it up.
Okay, man. Badass. Well, Chef Chris, thank you so much for talking to us, man. This has been great.
Hey, my pleasure. Where do I get to? What do you do now? Do you just is this gone out live on the airwaves?
It is. We are live right now, and then they record it, and it streams on SoundCloud later. So I'll send you a link once it gets posted. But yeah, man. Again, thanks for talking, and good luck with everything. And I'll see you again. I'll be out at Boogie Woogie Barbecue. I try to get out there at least a couple times a year.
Cool.
Yeah. And why don't you real quick? What do you got coming up for the future? Are you going to be playing anywhere or anything like that?
Yep, October 28th, we'll be at the Village Tap in Manchester, Michigan. It's on the corner of M52. And Main Street, the Nairobi Trio, and we'll be doing I Wish You Would. Here's a little sample. So there you have it.
Fucking A, man. All right. Well, we will see you there. You have a great one, man.
All right. Thanks a lot. Take care.
Yeah, you too. This is American Whiner. My name is Alex. We're on podcastdirect.com. Thank you so much for listening to us. I will be back next Wednesday with another friend of mine, and I will talk to you then.